Welcome to Supercharge My Practice, a podcast dedicated to helping you build a thriving and fulfilling natural therapies business. Each week, your host, Anil Mustafa, interviews leading practitioners and field experts, sharing proven tactics, inspiring stories, and actionable steps that will help you unlock your potential. Supercharge My Practice is proudly brought to you by My Appointments Practice Management System. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Supercharge My Practice. Today, I have Narel Pratt, who is the founder and principal HR consultant at HR for Health Leaders. With over 13 years of experience in human resources, she holds a Bachelor of Business degree with a major in human resource management and a postgraduate certificate in industrial relations. In addition to her HR background, Narel was a co-owner of a thriving remedial massage clinic, where she managed multiple therapists and administrative staff for over 4 years. With her practical background in both business management and HR, she offers a distinctive viewpoint on enhancing operations to hire, scale, and manage your team to success. Narel, welcome. Such a pleasure to have you here today.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start by diving into your personal experience as a business owner, because you owned a, or you co-owned a remedial massage clinic. So I want to talk to you about what difficulties you face, not necessarily around growing the practice in terms of marketing, but more so in terms of growing your team. Did you have difficulties, challenges, finding, maintaining new contractors and working out how to structure people? Give us a bit of a background on your experience as a practice owner.
Yeah, okay. So we had a clinic with three treatment rooms and a reception space. So we had a reasonable amount of size. And when we first started, I have to be honest, so probably takes a back step, you know, when we talk about subcontracting versus employment. We can talk about that a bit more as well. But essentially, you know, if you want to have subcontractors, you have to structure your business very specifically to avoid legal risks of it being sham contracting. Mm-hmm. So the way we wanted to structure our business very much meant we should have had employees. But even for me, when we first started, I sort of didn't even realize that either. Not that I didn't realize, it's probably more that everyone else has subcontractors, so that's what we should do. And the people, we had actually bought the clinic space off of another business. We ended up completely changing it and running it as a different business, which is a whole nother topic about doing good due diligence when you buy a business from someone. It's not always what you think it's going to be. We basically bought a space. We didn't really end up buying anything other than the space and what was in it. So then we had to start from scratch with staff. So we hired a couple of subcontractors, and we only did that for maybe 6 or 8 weeks before we realized that they actually really should be employees, and then we switched over. So some of the challenges we had at the start was definitely around the assumption or expectation of therapists that they want to be subcontractors. Because when you start trying to hire employees, you then have to go through the process of explaining to them why it's an employment role and not a contracting position and what that looks like, and how they're getting paid. If they're used to being paid, you know, $60 a treatment, for example, and you're telling them I'm going to pay $35 an hour and they think that that's a massive pay cut. And back when we started, I wasn't really clear on the metrics that would explain that to them, whereas now, after doing it for so long, I'm like, okay, well, you've got this, you've got time between clients, you've got the fact that you're never 100% booked, so actually we're going to pay you for, you know, X amount, and this is the comparison. It's quite easy to explain then, but I didn't know that at the start. So I guess there was the struggle around convincing people to come on as employees if they wanted to be contractors. And actually just finding staff. I don't know your experience, but it's often quite hard to find them. Yeah. We had quite a few graduates come in eventually, and quite a few of them stuck around for a couple of, like, one of them still works for the, so we sold the business probably 3 years ago now, I think it was. And one of the therapists who started out with us when we first opened is still there working for the new owner. You know, she's one of those stayers. That's what she loves. So that's definitely a challenge. And I think finding people that are aligned. So I guess particularly when you're a entrepreneurial spirit, like attracts like, So sometimes we attract people who have big goals and want big things for what they want to do, which sometimes isn't aligned with being an employee. So if you hire them knowing that they might stick around for a couple of years, but eventually they're going to want to do their own thing, like, that's cool. But if you hire them thinking they're going to be with you forever, you sometimes make the mistake of assuming that they will want to stay. Whereas, like, for example, the girl that worked for us is still there. She saw how much hard work we put into running the business, and she knew she didn't want that for herself.
Mm.
She was perfect. And she was happy to do stuff that we asked her to do that wasn't treating clients, but she wanted to switch off and go home and be done with it, you know. Mm. So she's a perfect employee. So
excellent. Yeah, no, it does. And it's quite, everything you say is very much relevant to me. Now, when I was in my practice and I had other practitioners working with me, it was, subcontracting was the norm. However, yeah, in recent years, the ATO has changed the ruling, and now a lot of practitioners are working as subcontractors, but it's considered a sham contract role. And we'll get into that a little bit later, as we're going to be discussing the differences between employees and subcontractors as well. But I think the biggest thing that I personally had a big challenge with is practitioners working as contractors and not understanding that when they were paying their percentage, that they were thinking you were making more money than they were. But when you've actually broke down the business expenses, they were making more money on their percentage than you were in your own.
They don't have other expenses. Absolutely.
The lighting, the toilet paper, all these little things that they don't realize that every time their client walks in the door, yeah, there's all these additional expenses that the practice has to cover that they, yeah, don't have to think about. Absolutely. So, yeah. And so
the software, the advertising, the, yeah, you know, the fees that you pay for the EFTPOS machine, the, you know, everything, right? Yeah, and if you've got admin, absolutely, the admin staff that you're paying, you know, there's a lot that goes into it that they don't see. Yeah, yeah,
absolutely.
That's another thing. I remember we had one staff member, he didn't stay very long. He was a mature age student. He'd come from a really good job in marketing, like six-figure salary, and had been made redundant, I think, from memory. And he decided he wanted a career change and decided to go into massage. And when he started with us, you know, we were like, look, we'll bring you on casual, and then as you get more clients, like, hopefully we'll get to a point where we can give you a full-time job. That's sort of the, you know, if that's your goal, that's what we can work towards. And that was fine. But after a few weeks, he was struggling. You know, he was raising concerns that he, you know, wasn't getting paid what he was hoping, I guess. And when we had a conversation with him, we actually had to say, like, how much do you want to earn? Like, what is your, what's your end goal? And he said $2,000 a week.
Wow.
And I was like, you do realize that you will never get paid that as an employee in massage. Like, that is just, it's not going to happen.
Even as a contractor, that's quite hard.
Exactly. I was like, you know, that's a lot of hours, and, you know, that's just not going to work. If you want to do that, like, you know, power to you, but that means running your own space, not contracting, not being an employee. You know, you're never going to get there working with us. And basically got it to a point where he self-selected and was like, okay, like, well, I don't want to stay here. And we were like, cool, because he wasn't a great fit. We started uncovering. But, yeah, so we sort of also learned to talk to people about their expectations and then sort of see whether that's going to actually fit in with the business and whether that's money expectations or expectations about what work they're going to do, because sometimes we found that, particularly for people who've been contractors, they're used to being paid for the treatment, and as part of that they got to do notes and change the towels properly, right? But they've probably never been asked to help on the front desk or to, you know, if you want them to do a bit of cleaning or help them write a blog post or do some social media or whatever the things are that you decide you would like them to help with. So when they would have gaps in between clients, you know, we would always ask, we'd had a little list of like 5 and 10 minute jobs, we used to call it. And some of them were bigger things. And it might be as simple as, like, you know, pulling out the dryer and cleaning all the lint behind it, right up to some of them were quite happy to write blog posts. So it was like, cool, can you write a blog post on this topic? Or a Facebook post on this topic. And because they're getting paid per hour, you know, like, they're like, okay, like, I'm at work, you're paying me to be here, like, I'll do that work for you, no problems. But sometimes we found that if people had come from contracting backgrounds, they're like, well, why would I do that? And you're like, because I'm paying you to be here. And if you don't have a client, I'm still paying you to be here. So, you know, it's really important to make that expectation clear up front. And it can evolve, but you want to make sure if you're hoping that someone's going to help with tasks outside of treating clients, that you discuss that up front and know that they're going to be okay with it.
Let's break this down, because the purpose of today's podcast is all about growing your practice, scaling your practice when you want to add a team member in. So we're going to go through some of the more technical things like wages and contracting versus employee and some other technical details, understanding how to hire and things like that. But I want to break down these complications that both you and I had, because it's really good for a practitioner who's wanting to bring another practitioner on into their practice to understand these things. Because had you known this, and I known this before we went down the route of employing people or contracting to people, I think it would have really saved us a lot of heartache as well.
Yeah.
So first thing you mentioned was setting expectations up front, and especially around money, about what to expect. Yeah. Obviously, we know, and we'll go into a bit more detail about contracting versus employment. But the other one that you mentioned is making sure that you have a task list of expectations.
Yeah.
Because that is something that if you've got a contractor, they're going to automatically say, well, I'm not getting paid, so I'm not going to do anything for you, versus an employee who's being employed to do whatever it is that you've employed them for. So having the right paperwork in place to make sure that they understand what their responsibilities are is going to avoid a lot of hassle down the track as well. Is there anything else that you think is absolutely pertinent that you found in your own experience that you would want somebody to know before they hired their first employee?
I think one of the things, you know, when I talk about expectations about what the person's going to do, is also being aware of what their skill set and interests are. So, you know, particularly with therapists, I guess this depends on which space you're operating in. So if we're talking about massage and probably some of the more holistic types of modalities, they often tend to be, this is very generalized, but personality-wise, they often tend to be like more caring and soft and not as, you know, they're not the personality types that are like, go get them and like smash it really hard. And, you know, that's not generally what the industry attracts, right? And so what you get them to do can also depend on the person. So for example, we had, with one therapist this is the one that's still working there, who's quite interested in details. So she's a bit of a softer personality, but she's also very details focused. And she loves learning, and she loves, she did like some graphic design study. So she's one that would do blogs and Facebook stuff for us. And actually she ended up working for us full time. So she'd massage about 3/4 of her week, and then the other quarter she'd be doing administrative stuff. So she'd sit on reception, but the purpose wasn't reception. The purpose was doing like social media and stuff for us. Now she was great at that. We had another therapist who was more the soft type, very caring, very spiritual. Like, she was really lovely. Clients loved her. But there's no way, and she also, English wasn't her first language. There's no way she would have had any interest in writing a blog post. Now, we could have made her, probably would have been not great. And it probably would have been a waste of time, because it would have taken her so much longer to execute that task. So and there's a difference between people not wanting to do things because they don't want to push themselves outside of their comfort zone a little, and it just being outside of their expertise. So it's a bit like us as business owners. So, and the reason I give the example of the personality type is, if you're the type that also doesn't like doing those things and you hire someone else who's like you, hoping that they're going to do the things that you don't like, but it's also not their skill set, then your expectations are a bit out of whack. Mm-hmm. So if you want to hire someone who's going to do certain things, then just keep that in mind and make sure that they're open to those types of things. And as we know, hard to find practitioners sometimes. So sometimes you've got to be a bit flexible in that. You go like, it would be awesome if I find someone to do the social media posts. Mm-hmm. But if I find someone who's a great practitioner and that's not their thing, that's okay too. I'll just make sure that there's enough other little clinic type jobs that they can keep themselves busy when there's no clients. And I'll get someone else to do the social media stuff.
And I want to go back to something that you said a little bit earlier about attracting the right types of personalities in your practice. So there's two things that I want to add to this, and let me know if it's the same experience on your end. For me, I found that the practitioners that had the best bedside manner, that were the most caring, not the ones that were the most experienced, not the ones that were the most knowledgeable, but the ones who had the best client bedside manner were much better in the clinical environment and at maintaining and building a practice than those that had more experience and more knowledge. And so for me, that meant that a lot of the times when I was looking for new practitioners, I would actually go with somebody who was a new graduate who I could mold and teach and grow in the clinical aspect, because you cannot teach patient bedside manner. You cannot teach those skills. They come naturally to someone, whereas clinical skills can always be taught. So I know for me, a couple of times I hired for experience, technical experience,
with
a personality. That person never, ever, ever lasted in my practice. Even more so, I found that their energy was so off-putting that we went from being a fully booked practice to getting a new practitioner on board to all of us, including me, and I had a waiting list all the time, being really, really quiet in the practice because I found I didn't like going into work anymore because of the energy of this person. And so what we do as business owners is that we keep people on board because we're nice, we're caring people. That's why we're in the industry, right? But then
we think, I can't find someone else and they're a good practitioner, so I better keep them.
But then the guilt. Oh, you know that they need the money. You know that, you know, that they may enjoy the work, even if you don't necessarily enjoy the energy, they might enjoy the work. And so we end up keeping people on in our business for longer than we should because we feel sorry for them, or we are too scared to say sorry, but it's not working yet.
Yes. That's 100% a problem. I was going to say as a business owner, as a person generally, like, I personally don't love conflict, right? So I know that I procrastinate on those hard conversations, which is hilarious because in HR, like.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're HR. This should be your, you know, you should be able to do this without thinking twice.
I can do it, but it doesn't mean I like it.
Right, yeah.
You know, and I'm quite a technical person, so I will happily give you the advice on how to do it. But the actual execution of it, it sucks.
Which is the lesson here, isn't it? Somebody who's in HR, who's obviously had a lot of experience in having to let people go, it never gets any easier. But what you need to understand for those listening, that if you do end up hiring someone and they don't feel like the right energy for you, don't let them destroy your business because you're not confident enough to tell them that they're not working out. And I say that with love because I struggled with this big time. And I was very young. I was 19 when I started my practice. And so going through that age, you know, in my 20s of having to deal with firing people, it was horrendous. It doesn't feel any good. But for me now, being older, I recognize that if I've got someone that's in my space, and it might not even be a team member, it could actually be a practitioner. I mean, it could be an administrator that has that same negative energy. And if you don't step up to do what you know you have to do for the sake of your business is going to suffer and you're the one that's got to pay the bills. So you have to step up and let those people know.
And I mean, and the other thing I say is, like, your clients will suffer, right?
Yes.
Say that because I know that practitioners would be like, okay, like, you know, they're like, my business, oh, well, that's me. Like, if I don't get paid, then, you know, like, but once we put that externally and you go, oh, okay, it's affecting my clients, I really need to do something about that. So,
and often we don't even know how much it's affecting our clients. You know, you've reminded me of something with somebody that I had, a practice manager that I had who was phenomenal. I loved her. I had a really good relationship with her, but she was a personal trainer as well. So she'd work on reception, but she also worked in my gym as the personal trainer too.
Right. Yeah.
And so it came to light after a bit of time that she had favorites. And so if certain gym members would come into the gym, personal training was included as part of my gym membership. So if a member came into the gym, she would be expected to go out and train those people. But what they were saying was that she had her select group of people that she wanted to train and she'd let the others go. And so I didn't know this. People hadn't told me this. And it wasn't until it had come to light that I realized that there was a problem. So sometimes even we have a good relationship with some of our employees, but that doesn't mean our customers do or our clients do. And so recognizing again that the clients have to come first, because if you don't have the clients to pay your bills, well, you don't really have a business.
That's a really good point. And it reminds me of we had a receptionist for a while. She didn't end up working out, but we really liked her as a person. She just wasn't very good at the job. And we had procedures and we'd like, you know, we gave her time and we offered training and, you know, and she just wasn't a great fit for the job. And it was really hard letting her go because, and she, you know, she took it quite personally for a while. And then I think she, you know, later on, she settled down with that decision. But it is, it's really hard when their other was a really nice person, but they're just not a good fit. And that's probably not as common with practitioners because I think if they're a nice person, unless their skills are terrible and they're not open to being training, that probably doesn't happen. But with administrative staff, sometimes they don't have the skill level or the right inclination to learn either, because that's, you know, you can teach skill, but for example, like I said, I'm technical. I love data. I love numbers, right? So if you gave me our weekly data, happy days, head in a spreadsheet, no problems. But we did have one receptionist who she wasn't really good with data, but I set her procedures and she knew how to find the data and she knew how to then put it into the spreadsheet. She probably had no idea what half of it meant, so I couldn't hand off to her that I wanted her to do some more analysis. But she did enough of the tasks to still take that job off of my hands. But she was never going to do it the way I would because she just doesn't have that inclination towards data. But in saying that, you know, like she was a great people person. So she made a good receptionist, but she didn't, and this is a problem, right? Some people who are good with data, like people with my type of personality often have terrible people skills. We're not like often the technical people, you know, think about engineers and, you know, all those people that end up in those very technical roles who often don't have very good social skills. And they're just not really interested in people very much. They're much more task orientated than they are people orientated. Mm-hmm. They feel perfectly certain sorts of roles, but they probably don't make a good receptionist, for example. Mm-hmm. But they would make great accountants for you.
Yeah.
You know, like, so. Yeah, it's really being aware of people's strengths.
Excellent. We've gone so far off topic. let's get into some of the pertinent questions that our listeners may want to know. So first of all, deciding on hiring a subcontractor versus renting out a room in your space versus employing someone. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, okay. So like I alluded to earlier, there's a couple of different pieces of legislation that cover contracting and employment versus employment, I'll say. So from an employment perspective, you've got the Fair Work Act. And the Fair Work Act talks about sham contracting. And the background of the details of why they have it is to protect people from being undercut in a nutshell. So imagine what started happening, I shouldn't say started. Sometimes what we see happen is people in lower paid jobs get taken advantage of. So, for example, people would subcontract out to cleaners. Cleaners are normally paid minimum wage anyway, right? So they would say, I'm going to contract you as a cleaner. You charge me $30 an hour on your ABN and happy days. And they probably would have made $25 an hour as a casual anyway, probably a bit higher than that now. So what was happening was these people were missing out. They were getting paid less than they would have if they were paid minimum wage. So to avoid that, the Fair Work Act, there's that and there's also entitlement. So there's also things like access to annual leave. So let's say you're a contractor, you've been working there for 5 years. Now, if you were an employee, you would have been full-time or part-time if you don't work full-time hours. You would have annual leave, sick leave, public holidays. You know, if you're there for 7 years, you get long service leave pro rata. There's all these little things that you get as an employee that you don't as a contractor. So Fair Work Commission's very focused on protecting employees, protecting people to getting the entitlements that they should be entitled to. So they have tests around, you know, if you're things that are more likely to make you an employee versus a contractor. And it's very similar to the tests that you find on the ATO website. So the ATO then also has legislation around contracting. They're more concerned about it from who's paying the tax bill so that they get paid, in a nutshell. Because that's a job, right? They're there to collect taxation and make sure that you're remitting your GST and your PAYG tax, like your pay-as-you-go tax, which is the tax you withhold from an employee's wage. And they care about making sure your superannuation is paid because they're responsible for enforcing the superannuation legislation as well. So they've got a very similar test about sham contracting. So if someone makes a complaint to the ATO, for example, and says, I should be an employee and I'm a contractor, the ATO would make a determination, but most of what they're concerned about is, have you paid them super? Because that's what they enforce. Whereas if you make a complaint to Fair Work and say, I'm a contractor, I think I should be an employee, they'll be looking at, okay, if you were employed under the award, what's the wage that you would have been paid? And have you been paid at least that, or have you been underpaid? So, you know, example would be, let's say you pay someone $50 a treatment and they see 10 clients, so they get $500. But let's say that you're in a shopping center, because this is where it happens, right? Mm-hmm. You expect the people to show up and be there for 8 hours a day, even if they see two clients. So the commission then says, oh, well, they've actually worked 30 hours and the minimum pay rate is, I'll pick an easy dollar, $30 an hour. That's not it, but let's keep math simple. You should have paid them $900, so you've underpaid them $400 that week. And then they'll do that calculation for how long that person's worked for you and enforce a back payment, as well as super on top of that, as well as sometimes a penalty, as well as, let's say, they've been there 5 years and they say, well, they actually should have been full-time. So you also owe them annual leave. So it can become a big issue. It is less of an issue from a risk underpayment perspective if you're paying them very well. Like, let's say you've got a practitioner who's really well booked and they get $50 a treatment. You probably don't have an underpayment issue because you probably paid them more than the minimum wage, but that doesn't mean that you can't still get penalised and still get lumped with super and still be forced to make them an employee if they made a complaint. So there's a lot of moving parts on that. But essentially the contracting, you know, some of the tests are around the amount of control you want over them, whether they're running their own business, for want of a better word. You know, do they have their own brand? Are they allowed to go and get their own clients? Do they work elsewhere? Can they hire contractors to do the work for them, or do they have to deliver the work themselves? You know, do they wear your uniforms and present as part of your business to the outside world is often a pretty good indication. So what I find is most of the time when people are wanting to engage a practitioner for their clinic, most of the time the amount of control they want over the way that person works indicates they would have an employee is sort of the summary version of it. I've got an ebook that I'm happy to send you a link to that people can download for free. It's pages of information that goes into a bit more of the technical detail, and it's got links to like the tests on the ATO website that you can go and have a look at and do the little questionnaire, and it will give you its opinion. So
we'll pop that in the show notes as well. So just to break this down a little bit more simply, if you were to have a contractor that worked in your practice, let's say they don't work anywhere else, they work with you, say, 4 or 5 days a week, they wear their own uniform, they've chosen their own hours, you might supply the towels and the oils and the treatment table for them. Would you in that case still be able to have that person on as a contractor, or would they, because they're working in your clinic, would you still, and they're not working elsewhere, would you still have to essentially at least pay their superannuation to keep them on as a contractor?
Yeah, so there's two halves to that question. So the first bit about whether they can be a contractor, it really depends on the totality of the relationship and the contract you have in place. And I'll preface this by saying I'm not a lawyer, so I don't advise on contracting. I sort of give general advice about these are the two sides of the coin. Here's the information. Go away and decide, you know, how you want to go about it. And then if you want to do employees, I can talk to you. And if you think you still want to pursue contractors, then I've got some lawyers details that I can send you to go talk to. So it's sort of some of the things I would ask is like, who does the marketing? Who owns the clients? You know, because if they're wearing their own uniform and those sorts of things, you know, but you're basically supplying everything to them, clients, et cetera, as well, you know, are they really running their own business? Like if you went to court, would the court say, yes, they're a legitimate contractor? And that's sort of, and this is where the legal advice is useful. I do know a few people that do contracting, but a lot of them have moved to renting space rather than calling it contracting. And I've got a link. There's actually a lawyer that's written a good article about this. They call it like a facilities management agreement. It just gives like a little bit of an overview. So in that case, rather than them being a contractor, they're essentially renting the space from you on either a fixed value. So let's say like $200 a week for the room or whatever the value is, or on a percentage base. You can still do that as a facilities agreement, but it's a very technical legal thing the way it's set up. And the advice that the lawyers gave me when I spoke with them about this was you still have to tick the box to make sure it's not a sham contract. But just when you call it, like it's the old, if it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck, even if you try and tell me it's a chicken. You know, so they've said you still got to tick the boxes, but it's a better option than doing it the other way.
Because you don't see, like in anyone that you see that comes to see you for help in their businesses, do you see a lot of people moving to the employment space now? Because for me, being, you know, 23 years in practice, it's so rare for, unless you're working in a day spa or something like that, it is so rare for a natural healthcare practitioner to be employed by a practice. So is it now that because of these sham contracting that more people are moving towards employment as opposed to contracting?
Yeah, we'll put it this way. In what I've been doing this about 4 years, I've had hundreds of clients employ staff. So I definitely see a lot of it.
It's definitely the safer route to go. Yeah, it's also very hard as a business owner though, because then you're stuck with paying somebody a wage.
Yeah. You have to be really clear on your costs, which is not always the strength of massage and, you know, natural health practitioner types. This is the whole personality thing, right? They're not often great with numbers and they've not been taught. So one of the things I've got is like a, you know, just a simple it's not a spreadsheet. I've tried to keep it like a pretty document because I know that pretty often is much easier for people to, for their minds to comprehend than like boring spreadsheet numbers. But essentially it's like, okay, so if you charge this much and you pay them this much and their appointments are booked, let's say on average 80 to 90% of the time is my experience, you very rarely, unless you have awesome wait lists and systems, very rarely will you have practitioners with 100% booked. You know, and there's often, you know, they've done a 90-minute treatment instead of a 60, so then there's this stupid 30-minute gap you can't do anything with, and, you know, you get stuff like that, right? So when you average it out, they probably do 80 to 90% of their total available bookings. So then that's how I work out, A, your profitability, or like I should say your revenue, and then B, how much the wages are going to cost you, and then you can see the profitability. And you can also compare that on a percentage basis. So if you're used to paying 50, 60, whatever your contract percentage is, and then you do the wage numbers and you see that actually it's pretty similar as long as I charge this, pay this, and they're this amount percentage booked. So then you start having the real KPIs for the business as well, where you can say, okay, if they're not 80% booked, like I have a problem. You know, I've got to do something about my marketing or their rebooking or whatever it is that's causing the dip in bookings. But you know that that's a KPI you need to care about. Mm. And you know that that's directly impacting the bottom line, essentially. So, and with the super, so the super legislation says that, and again, not an accountant, so this is general non-tax advice, but basically generally what the ATO's website says is that if you're engaging someone who is a sole trader who works wholly and principally for their labour, then you're responsible for their superannuation because they're considered an employee for superannuation purposes. This is not for tax or employment law, but technically that's what the super legislation says. So this has actually been around for quite a while, so it's not a particularly new thing, but the new thing is they started enforcing it and people started hearing about it. And then employees started complaining to the ATO, and the ATO will then do an audit if an employee complains or a worker, they're a contractor, complains, and they will make you back pay it. And I knew someone who had a very large, close to six figure super bill. They had had a clinic with 7 to 10 practitioners for like 10 years. Wow. They had a massive bill because they just didn't know. So, yeah. And a lot of people don't. So that is definitely a big thing to watch out for.
And what about in terms of if you do decide to employ someone, is it, what's the relevant award, or what kind of, what's the minimum wage that you'd pay someone in our industry?
Yeah, so we have one main system in Australia, which is Fair Work Act. And then you have the Health Professionals and Support Services Award, which covers, I'm assuming, anyone in your anyone you're talking to, basically all allied health professionals. It's physios, chiros, osteos, massage therapists, myotherapists, dietitians, naturopaths, nutritionists, as well as like dental assistants and a few other random things that go in with that. So that encompasses pretty much everyone. I'll make one little preface. If you are in WA and you are a sole trader, a partnership or a trust who doesn't have a company entity, so you're not a PTY LTD, you're covered by the WA system, because WA likes to do things differently.
Yeah.
So it's a bit different in WA. You could, if you're a massage therapist, there's an award. If you have admin staff, there's an award. If you have the other professions like physios, et cetera, there's not generally an award. So that's a bit different. So if you're one of those, just ask me. But otherwise, everyone else pay attention to this bit. So Health Professional Support Services Award. And it basically has levels and pay points, it calls it. So a graduate massage therapist, for example, so diploma qualified, would start at a level one pay point one. And then if you are a, what's the next one? I think a bachelor degree starts at advanced diplomas, pay point two, bachelor degrees, level three, and then I think it goes up to masters and then doctorate. So that's sort of the progression. So depending on what sort of practitioner you're hiring depends on where they start in the pay scale. And then they progress through the pay scale for each year of full-time or equivalent experience. So if they work full-time hours with you, then each year they go up a pay point. So let's say they're a massage therapist, they start at pay point one, then they go to pay point two, three. There's six pay points in level one before they get to level two. But if you're hiring a chiropractor who has a doctorate degree, which I think they normally do for chiropractors, then they're probably starting, off the top of my head, I think they start at a five. So it's only going to take them 2 years to get to a level two employee because they start so much higher. If you've got casual staff, then let's say for argument's sake they work half of a full-time role, it'll take them 2 years to progress. So the starting pay point very much depends on the qualification and their level of experience. And then you sort of got a couple of different things to be aware of. So you've got a pay rate from Monday to Friday, and then you've also got a shift work rate that would apply to certain clinics after 9 p.m. and to other clinics after 6 p.m. So massage, for example, is after 6 p.m., whereas a physio, osteo and chiro is after 9 p.m. And it's just really, it's wording in the award that really needs to be reviewed, but hasn't yet. So it's sort of unfortunate because it's like, well, of course, massage therapists work late. Why is it not normalised for them as well? So. That's how that sits at the moment. And then you have a weekend rate, so Saturday and Sunday work. And then you have overtime rates, but they only apply if you work more than 38 hours a week or more than 10 hours a day, which basically never happens in allied health. Maybe if you're a salaried like physio or something and, you get some, I don't know, you might do more than 38 hours one week, but it's pretty unusual for a practitioner to work overtime. So.
And do you know what that equates to, like in a dollar figure? Like, is a base level one somebody?
Yeah, so level one pay point one. It's roughly $35 an hour. For a permanent, I think it's about $29. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the starting point. So and then it just goes up from there. So then your weekend rates, I think it's 150% of the base rate, and then the overtime. Overtime doesn't really matter that much. So. So normally you end up paying quite a high rate on a weekend. So normally my advice to clients is like you want to really make sure that your weekend shifts are very well booked, which they normally are because, people always want to get in on Saturday. But make sure everyone's booked back to back, no gaps. If you have a gap, move a client, make sure you're filling all the space. It'll still be a profitable shift. You just can't afford to have the gaps as much as you would on a weekday, basically. Mm.
Now, I know this one you covered earlier, but I just want to break it down a little bit more. And that's understanding how to work out how much you can afford to pay your workers, whether they're a contractor or an employee. Can you just touch again on that? Because you looked at, you know, their maximum capacity to work is, say, 80%, and you work backwards from there. But can you just touch on that and break that down into some really simple steps for somebody who's trying to work out how much they can afford to pay a worker?
Yeah, so let's say there's probably two sides to it, right? So one is understanding the overall business costs and how much money you need to make to run the clinic. And that'll so let's say that you need, I don't know, $1,000 a week to run your clinic. I'll just pick a number. And you've got three practitioners, then each of them needs to make you $330 profit to cover the $1,000 a week. So that's sort of one side of it. And then the other side of it is how you get to that $330 individually for the therapist. And then if you extrapolate that further, let's say you then have four therapists, they only need to make you $250 each, or if they're all making you at least $330, then you now have actual profit on top of the costs of running the business. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Think about that sort of that way. But then if you think about it at a practitioner level, so let's say you've got a therapist who's got 10 appointment spots available per week. Now, most clients, and for this purpose, I'll assume that they're one-hour appointment slots because it's easy calculations, and that you have 15 minutes in between every client because that seems to be fairly standard for most practitioners. That probably changes a bit for, you know, physios and people that have full reception coverage or chiros. So we'll keep it simple for the purposes of this. That means each treatment takes 1 hour and 15 minutes with the gap in between clients. So to do those 10 treatments, they're available for 12 and a half hours of work. So if you're paying them an hourly rate, let me do a quick calculation because I can't. Now that the rates change, it's hard to keep up. So if we do $35 an hour and 12.5 hours a week, assuming they're a new graduate massage therapist, that's about $440 plus super. So if they're a contractor and they've got the same 10 appointments available, but you know that they're probably only going to do 8 of those, and then you're paying them $50 a treatment, you've paid them $400 for those 8 treatments. So you can see how it ends up being, you can see how you can calculate if it's going to be similar or not. So if in your mind you think a good profitability point is, you know, roughly 60% of profit is wage cost, which is probably about average. It does vary a little bit. In my experience with massage, that's probably about average. We would have some weeks, particularly with the full-time staff, because their hourly rate is lower, there'd be some weeks where they might only cost us 50% of their revenue. But equally, they then take leave during the year. So you need to account for the fact they don't make revenue when they're taking leave. So it's okay if they cost you less, but for a casual staff member, you know, around 60, if it's more than 70, then you're probably paying too much and or you aren't booked enough or you're not charging enough, you know, one of the three.
All right, so now let's look at you're about to hire someone. What are some writing, like, descriptions on how to put an ad out there? Yeah. And conducting interviews and reference checks to make sure that this person is going to be a good fit for you?
Yeah, so my general advice with job ads is to write them with some personality in it. You know, if you want to attract someone who's the right personality fit for your business, and not just personality, but, you know, culture and the way their view of the world, which is not just personality based, you really want to display who you are as a business. So don't just write like a boring, like, you know, you must have this, must have that, we'll pay you and we'll pay you super. And, you know, it's like, well, that's just sort of a given. You know, think about it the same way you do marketing for your ads. You know, put a bit of like, you know, we're a really, you know, we help these sorts of people and we really care about X. And, you know, like the clinic we were running, we had a very casual style. We had a couple of male therapists, so we actually attracted a lot of trades. We used a lot of language that was, how would I explain that? A bit more like you were just talking to a mate, like very casual, even in our advertising. Because that was the type of client we wanted to attract. So we wanted to attract a therapist who was equally comfortable in that sort of environment. So we made sure that we used language like that in our job ads, which goes to a way to helping to connect the right people. So, you know, writing a job description, that's really going back to the first part of the conversation where we talked about expectations. You know, yes, you've got expectations of how they're going to behave as a therapist, but then do you have other things that you'd like them to do that you want to put in there? And that can be as simple as putting things like, you know, assist with administrative stuff and, you know, assist with cleaning around the clinic and keeping things tidy. Then it's in there. And then when you're talking about interviews, so if you've had a few candidates, you can do a we normally do a phone screen, but often if you don't have a lot of candidates, it might be just a short 5-minute call to book an interview. But you can do a phone screen as well. I've certainly done that in my corporate roles where I've had, you know, 10 shortlisted applicants and I'm trying to figure out who to interview. Or you'll particularly find this with admin staff. I find that you get lots of volume of administrative applicants if you ever advertise for a role. So I've also done application forms. So using like a Google form or a Microsoft form to quite simply ask them a few questions, a bit like you would on a phone screen, but saving yourself the time of phone screening 10 people. And then you pick the ones that you like the responses that they gave you, and then you call them and then you book the interviews. So that works really well. And actually having a couple of structured interview questions, because it's really helpful, particularly if you have a couple of good candidates and you're not sure who to pick. We have that bias of liking people who are like us. And if you want someone, and that's fine if that's going to fit what you want, but we also get blinded by that sometimes as well. If we're, you know, like the example, if you're trying to hire a data-driven bookkeeper, you don't want them to be like the airy-fairy therapist. You know, they have a different skill set. So you're just being aware of that so that, yeah, so having some good interview questions is good, because then you can go back and refer to it. You're like, what did I write about this person versus that person, if you need some more objective stuff? And reference checks are interesting, because a lot of people will say, what's the point? Because, you know, no one's ever going to put someone down who's going to give them a bad reference. And that's mostly true, though I have had a couple of people who were like, did they really put you down as a reference? This was not in massage. This was in my corporate jobs in the past. And normally if they decline to give you a reference, that's an absolute red flag. That's a problem. But you can ask questions around, be a good one, like, you know, what are some of their opportunities for growth? And people will generally give you an honest answer to that. And then you can see whether those are things that are going to work for you or whether they might be problems. Depending on what you get out of that. So they can still be useful.
And in terms of finding contractors or employees, let's call them practitioners for the sake of not worrying about the terms, association newsletters or magazines are a great place. Obviously, you can go on Seek, you can go in local Facebook groups for practitioners. Yeah. Putting up ads up there. Is there anywhere else that you would recommend somebody look?
There's a couple of free ones online you can try. So there's like Jura and Indeed. We used Gumtree before. It sounds crazy, but we actually got a couple of decent applicants out of that. I don't know how popular that is now though, because that was like 5-6 years ago, and I feel old sometimes when I say I use Gumtree, because I'm pretty sure all the young ones just use Facebook Marketplace
probably now. Yeah. And what about putting a sign on your door? Would you ever put a sign on your window the way you see restaurants kind of do it? I don't know that I would do that personally, but
didn't. I have heard people do that, but we never did that. You could try it. I guess it depends on the area, but I have had people say that they've had therapists referred to them because I think they said it was like, you know, they had a client who then was like, oh, you're looking for someone. I know this other person. And then it could be useful. Mm-hmm. What else have I done? Actually, if you're willing to hire grads, going directly to the TAFEs or colleges. Oh, yeah.
Excellent. Good
yeah,
one.
Going That's to their fun. Student clinics and having a treatment, seeing if you like any of them and asking them if they're looking for work, mm-hmm. literally. And you can hire them before they graduate as well. Depending on if you want to do that, and this is probably not relevant for some of the APRA registered professions, you know, because I'm sure they can't do anything. I don't think they can treat unsupervised until they're registered. But because something like massage is actually unregulated, for want of a better word, you know, we have associations, but it's not mandatory to be in one. I've had clients hire students sort of in their last couple of months. They put them on as like a deep tissue therapist. They don't advertise them as remedial. And then once they get their qualification, they switch them over and they make it, you know, they don't try and lie about it to clients. So clients are happy because it's transparent. Mm-hmm. But that's sometimes a good way to get them in if they're willing to do a few hours and if you're willing to do the training with them. Mm-hmm. So that's another one.
So the last technical question I've got for you is on employment contracts and any recommended documents for hiring staff. What's your advice around this?
Yeah, so I would definitely advise having a written employment contract. So there's technically nothing in the legislation that says you have to. If you think about contract law generally, so let's say you buy something on Facebook Marketplace and you exchange $50 for that thing that you've just bought, that is a contract of sale. Just because it wasn't in writing doesn't mean that it's not legally a contract. Mm-hmm. You get the same thing with employment. Just because it's not in writing doesn't mean it's a contract. The problem is how do you argue that if someone disagrees with something, how do you say what the actual agreement was? Because there's no record of it in writing. So that's one bit. And then the other bit is you can put a lot of other information in a contract that is not just how much I'm going to pay you per hour. So so let's say, for example, you pay someone a salary, and I'll pick it because it's an easy example. So let's say the award says that the minimum salary you have to pay someone is, let's pick $60,000. I can't remember exactly what the minimum is at the moment. And you pay them $70,000 a year, and they're expected to work one Saturday a month. And you don't need to pay them any extra for working the Saturday because you're already paying them a salary that pays more than you would have paid if you had paid them under the award. But if you don't have that in writing and then someone says, oh, well, the award says I'm supposed to get a higher hourly rate for working a Saturday and you've never paid me that, how do you argue that the salary was supposed to include compensation for the Saturday? So that's sort of some of the reasons it's really important to have a contract. And then other things, you know, sort of more industry specific things, I put a lot of that in contracts when I do them, is most clinics are too small to make it worth having a whole bunch of procedures, right? Like you don't need a procedure about PPE, like personal protective equipment and uniforms, just to tell someone that it's a requirement of their job that they wear the branded shirt that you provide them, and you expect them to wear black pants or shorts and sneakers or whatever your uniform situation is, right? So when I do contracts, I literally have a whole bunch of small sections that are things that you might have in a procedure if you were a big business that you can just cover off quickly in a contract. So things like uniforms and having your mobile phone on silent and being aware that you should not wear too much perfume and that you should be like nicely groomed because you're really close with clients. Mm-hmm. Because you know, the amount of times I've heard people say, oh, they, you know, they wear too much perfume and we've got clients with smell sensitivities and then it's really awkward and how do you tell them that? It's much easier when you're like, look, we do have this in the contract, like just be cautious of this, or you know, and then stuff as simple as like confidentiality with clients, ownership of intellectual property. And so that can be anything from your client list, so that they don't go and attempt to poach your clients if they start a business up the road, through to, let's say you do social media. Let's say they're helping you write social media content and then they want to go start their own job up the road and they take all the content they've written for you. You know, that's actually your intellectual property because you've paid them to develop that content. So you can put stuff around, restrictions around that in writing in your contracts. And the practical things, like let's say they're full-time and you want them to, you know, ideally they give you 2 months notice when they take leave. Now, if you don't have that in there, it falls back on the award, which doesn't really stipulate anything. But because you know you've got clients booked in and you're going to have to shuffle them, you really want to ask for notice. And, again, you could put that in a procedure, but you don't need a three-page document about leave when you have three employees, you know. You just need a couple of guidelines in their contract. So that ticks off a lot of that by having it written down. Mm-hmm. And then just in terms of documents, you know, something like position descriptions, you know, you always attach that to the contract. There's some legislative things you have to do. So you have to give someone the Fair Work Information Statement. And if they're casual, you have to give them the casual supplement that goes with it. thing, you have to give them like a super form and a tax form and, you know, collect their bank details and stuff. So you've got to do those things. If you've got like a code of conduct, you know, and that could be like a one pager, but I mean, often in a clinic, you don't necessarily need that either, because if they've all got association membership, there's a code of conduct that comes with having a professional membership. So it's not necessary really that you have to do that, but if you did have one, you can provide things like that. Yeah, they're probably some of the main ones.
So the short answer is, if you want to get a team member, don't. It's far too complicated. No, I'm just kidding. Go and find someone to help you. It is, look, it's all quite overwhelming for someone who's doing it for the first time. And I want to say that don't feel like you're overwhelmed by this information. Just know that there is support out there. If you are looking to expand, you can go out and find people to do it. I know for me, it was really daunting. But once you've been through it, and certainly if you've had someone holding your hand through that process, it's actually not as complicated as what it sounds. But for those hearing this for the first time that feel like they want to run away, having heard all of this information and feeling really overwhelmed, don't be, because there are people like Narelle out there. So, Narelle, tell us a little bit more about your services and how our listeners can find a bit more about you and to work with you.
Yeah, no problem. So, so I mostly work with allied health professionals. That's sort of that's my jam, as you can tell. Like, it's really I really enjoy it. I know a lot about how clinics work. It's really great being able to help businesses that are out there helping clients. You know, I'm not just working for some big corporate who's, I don't know, making millions and whatever they're doing. So it's really rewarding for me. And I really like being able to blend what I know about how a clinic operates and what I know about HR to actually give advice to people who are like, oh, my God. Oh. Mm-hmm. And the amount of clients I've had who've said, I've been putting this off for months or years because I thought it was going to be so hard, and you just made it so much simpler. I'm like, oh, I'm glad I'm making a difference. So I've got an on-demand employment masterclass. So basically it goes into detail about some of the things we discussed in terms of like all the wages and all the calculations and how you do the profitability and more technical stuff on the legislative side and what you need to know. And then I've got a bunch of information sheets that go with that. So because I know it is a lot of information, I've got like a pay rate guide. So instead of reading the award, there's just a little summary that's like, this is practitioners and this is admin staff. And here's the key points about when which one applies. And, you know, that's it. So I've kept it really simple so you don't have to take notes and, you know, try and remember all the information. And a couple of info sheets that are like, yes, refer back to this. Here's the information you need. So that makes it much less overwhelming. I've got like the little worksheets about the profitability that we talked about so that people are like, okay, I've got that. I can, you know, I can do this. So trying to make that as simple as possible. I've also got some recruitment documents. So just like a simple example job descriptions and ads and information on where to post them and reference check and interview forms and an example application form so that you can literally just copy and paste, stick your logo on them and you've already got them. And then I do employment contracts as well. So very industry specific for allied health. That's what I do with those. So they've got all the things I mentioned about, you know, the mobile phone and uniforms and all the things in there that you want to see. And same thing, I've got the pack of documents to go with it. So you don't have to go find like a tax form and a super form, and you don't have to make your own bank details form. It's just like, download it, use that. Here's a, add your logo here and off you go. Yeah. And then I also provide advice. So, you know, if you do, I know most of you are probably listening, you haven't got employees yet, but let's say you hire someone and it's not going very well and you're not sure what to do about that. I also provide that sort of advice. Thankfully, I don't have to do that often because most of my clients don't have large issues because they hire well. But one thing I always remember hearing someone say was, hire slow, fire fast.
I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. So take your time to decide correctly on the person you're going to offer the job to. But when you know they're not a good fit, move quickly. Don't sit around. And, you know, and I say fire fast tentatively because I'm like, don't just fire them on the spot and don't follow procedure and get yourself in trouble. But make a decision to progress that as soon as you know that they're not a good fit.
And you've ticked all the checks and balances in the meantime as well. Yeah, absolutely. So website, social media, let us know what they are. I'll add them into the show notes as well. But if you could let my listeners know what your website is and your socials.
Yeah, easy. So my website's just hrforhealthleaders.com.au, really simple. And my socials are hrforhealthleaders. So very easy. I'm on Insta and Facebook, so you can find me there. Yeah.
Excellent.
That's me.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here today. Thank you for imparting your knowledge with my listeners today. It's much appreciated.
If it wasn't too overwhelming, we try.
And if it was, it doesn't matter because you're there to help. And you, like you said, you've got some free guides and you've got some masterclasses and your services are very, very affordable, the templates and things that you have as well. So please reach out to Narelle if you are finding it is a bit overwhelming for you. You do have support there.
Yeah, absolutely. Great.
Thanks again.
Thanks.
Thank you for tuning in today, and I look forward to having you join me in the next episode. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast to stay up to date with the latest releases. And for more helpful tips, look for me on Instagram under the handle Supercharge My Practice. This podcast is proudly sponsored by My Appointments.